Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, which I will entitle Death Comes to All. Very cheery thought. Solomon is going to continue with his somewhat cynical attitude towards life. As we start in Ecclesiastes 9, verse 1, Solomon begins, "Indeed, I took all this to heart and explained it all. The righteous, the wise, and their works are in God's hands. People don't know whether to expect love or hate. Everything lies ahead of them." Now, this word "indeed" connects this verse to the previous chapter, so therefore we can understand what Solomon means when he says, "I took all this to heart." He took all what to heart? Well, he was referring to the ways of God, especially in the matter of the wicked prospering and the righteous suffering. It doesn't make any sense, but Solomon's going to explain it. Well, let's look at what he's referring to. Let's read the last verse of the last chapter, Ecclesiastes 8, verse 17. Solomon says, "I observed all the work of God and concluded that man is unable to discover the work that is done under the sun." Unable to discover God's works. Unable to discover providence. Unable to discover what the heck is going on down here. The righteous are suffering and the wicked. So Solomon says in the last verse of Ecclesiastes 8:17 that man is unable to discover the work of God that is done under the sun. Even though a man labors hard to explore it, he cannot find it. Even if the wise man claims to know it, he is unable to discover it. So Solomon says, "I take this to heart and I explain it this way. Everybody's in God's hands." God's hands, of course, is God's providence. God decides what's going to happen in the future. You don't know. You don't know that if you practice righteousness, you're going to end up in a happy situation because the righteous suffer. And you don't know that the wicked are going to be judged because sometimes the wicked prosper. Everything is in God's hands. People don't know whether to expect love or hate. They don't know in their life if people are going to love them and they're going to be in a prosperous, happy situation, or they don't know whether people are going to hate them and oppress them. Everything lies ahead of them because we cannot know the future. Solomon expresses the idea about not knowing what to expect because everything lies ahead in the future. He expresses that in the 8th chapter, the last chapter of Ecclesiastes, verse 7. "Yet no one knows what will happen, because who can tell him what will happen? Nobody can." How can you argue with Solomon? And yet, people assume that everything's going to be all right. I can find happiness in this life if I just work hard, get rich, marry the right person that I can use to get where I want. We move now to Ecclesiastes 9, verses 2 through 3. Solomon continues, "It is the same for all. There is one fate for the righteous and for the wicked, for the good, for the clean, and for the unclean, for the man who offers a sacrifice and for the one who does not sacrifice. As the good man is, so is the sinner. As the swearer is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that there is one fate for all men." And what fate would that be? Let me stop here a minute and ask the obvious question. What's the same fate for all men? We're all going to die. "Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead." It is the same for all, Solomon says in verse 2. Here's a good commentary on that thought by John Gill. "If Abraham was rich in cattle, gold, and silver, so was Nabal." Nabal, of course, was the fool who tried to shortchange David and got David so angry David was about to go in there and kill him until Abigail, Nabal's wife, gave David a bunch of presents. So Abraham was rich, but so was Nabal, the rich fool, rich. "If Joseph was advanced to great dignity in Pharaoh's court, so was Haman in the court of Ahasuerus, Xerxes. Joseph was good, Haman was bad, both of them were powerful. If Caleb was as hardy and strong at 85 as ever, it is true of many wicked men, that there are no bands in their death, and their strength is firm to the last. Caleb was strong at 85, Caleb of Caleb and Joshua fame, the two spies that gave a good report as the Israelites moved into the land, or tried to. But there's a lot of strong men wicked at the end. If Moses, Solomon, and Daniel were wise men and of great learning, so were the idolatrous Egyptians. And so were many God is not pleased to call by his grace. We could think of the Babylonians. How about the philosophers of the environment? How about the philosophers of the Enlightenment? If Demetrius had a good report of all men," I'm not sure which Demetrius Gill is talking of here, "so had the false prophets of old. I think Demetrius was one of Paul's traveling companions. I can't remember. And the same adverse things happened to one as to another as the instances of Job, Lazarus, the Jews carried into captivity show. Bad things happened to Job. He was a good man. The Jews carried into captivity. They were bad. Lazarus was apparently a good man. Boom, he dies, ends up in the grave. Now, this fact, which nobody can deny, that the righteous suffer and that the wicked sometimes prosper, increased problems for us. Here are some of the problems. First of all, the wicked don't fear retribution and therefore sin more because they see wicked people prospering. They think, well, I can get away with it too. Second problem is the righteous are not encouraged to be righteous. They think, well, I can be righteous. Well, what good is it going to do me? I'm going to suffer anyway. Look at Job. The third problem that this suffering of the righteous and prosperity of the wicked creates is that God's righteousness may be impugned by infidels. They'll say, aha, God's a God of justice, huh? Well, look at this wicked man. He wasn't judged. Now, here are some possible answers to the problem. First possible answer is that the evils that befall the righteous are due to the general effects of the fall, not to their individual actions. And both the righteous and the wicked have to live in a fallen world. Here's what Adam Clark says. The evils that are in nature are the effects of the fall of man, and God will not suspend general laws or alter them to favor individual cases, nor does he desire that his approbation or disapprobation shall be shown by any of these occurrences. Well, that's true. If God's going to send a tsunami somewhere, he's going to send a tsunami. However, that does not mean, I think Clark needs to be refined a little bit here, that does not mean that you cannot pray individually that you escape the tsunami. That's not a suspension of natural laws or general laws. And besides, God can suspend general laws. They're called miracles when that happens. Another one of my commentators, I've lost the site, says, there is evil enough to show that man has fallen from God, and good enough to show that God deals with him in mercy. I cannot see that there is any rational cause for me to stumble at the dispensations of divine providence on these accounts. Well, I don't know who that was, but I'm glad he's happy about that. But Job was stumbling over it. I've stumbled over it. I think a lot of people stumble over it. Why do the righteous suffer? It's a hard thing to watch. Read the accounts of those early Christian martyrs. It's terrible. But God knows what he's doing. Well, that's the first way to answer the problem of the righteous suffering and the wicked prospering, is that we both have to live in a fallen world. But I think the best way to answer the problem is look at this suffering and prosperity going to the wrong people. Look at it from the point of view of eternity. If you do that, the apparent injustice dissolves. Why is that? Because the righteous will live with God forever in perfect bliss, and the unrighteous will suffer in hell in torment forever. Now there's where the justice evens out. But we need to remember that Solomon is not talking about the afterlife. He's talking about life under the sun, that phrase he keeps repeating. He's trying to find meaning in this life, and he finds that that's futile. You can't reconcile the problems. You can't explain why the righteous suffer and the evil men prosper. I think there's your answer right there, the under-the-sun answer, I'll call it. Now, some people say that verse 2 is not even Solomon's sentiment, but it's... rather he is quoting an objector, some cynic who's saying, it is the same for all, there's one fate for the righteous and one for the wicked. I don't believe that. That's a cop-out. It's used a lot, but I don't believe that. I believe Solomon is talking about what happens in this life, and who can deny it? It's true. One fate for the righteous and the wicked. We're all going to die. For the good, for the clean and the unclean, that's referring to Levitically clean and Levitically unclean. The one who eats shrimp is unclean. The one who does not eat shrimp is clean. Not talking about moral cleanliness and uncleanliness. For the man who offers a sacrifice and for the one who does not sacrifice, the one who offers a sacrifice would be an obedient Jew. The one who does not sacrifice would be perhaps a Gentile. As the good man is, so is the sinner. The one who is generally civically good, moral person, he dies. So does the sinner who's out there cavorting with prostitutes, he dies. As the swearer is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. To swear means to take an oath. So as the one who takes an oath is, he dies. So is the one who is afraid to take an oath, he dies. Now, what kind of oath is being talked about here? I assume Solomon means that the oath is either a rash oath or a false oath. So the swearer would be one who does something bad. He swears a rash oath or a false oath. But the one who is afraid to swear is a good man who wants to be sure he's accurate when he swears. He doesn't want to be a perjurer, and he doesn't want to take a rash oath because they're stupid. He wants to swear with awe and reverence of God. He wants to be sure he's telling the truth. Doesn't matter, though. He's going to die just like the one who takes a rash oath or the one who perjures himself. Verse 3, Solomon says, "This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, and there is one fate for all men." One fate, they're all going to die. Notice that Solomon says that this is an evil, dying. Dying is said to be an evil. I don't know who could deny that. It's a bad thing. It's not natural. It's not the way God made us. Nobody really wants to die unless they're going to commit suicide, and there are very few people who will commit suicide, even though life stinks for them at the moment. At the end of verse 3, Solomon says, "Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead." Well, that's bad, all right. But the good man ends up in the same place that this man full of evil and insanity ends up, in the grave. We go down to Ecclesiastes 9, verses 4 through 6. Solomon continues, "For whoever is joined with all the living, there is hope. Surely a live dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know they will die, but the dead do not know anything, nor have they any longer a reward, for their memory is forgotten. Indeed, their love, their hate, and their zeal have already perished, and they will no longer have a share in all that is done under the sun." Now here Solomon is just talking about what I just said, how bad it is to die. If you're alive, at least you have the hope of something good happening in the future while you're still alive. But as soon as you're dead, you will be like a dead lion, worthless. A live dog is better than a dead lion. In fact, you will be worth less than a live dog. A dog can pant and smile and lie in the sun and chase rabbits and be petted under his chin, but you, my friend, are in the grave. Verse 5, "For the living know they will die, but the dead do not know anything." You will be in the grave, and you won't know what's going on. You no longer have a reward, and guess what? People are going to forget you. Your memory will be forgotten. A live dog is happier than you. Now we need to take a theological rabbit trail here because these verses are often used by those who preach soul sleep, something which I absolutely do not believe in. The soul sleepers say, "Ha ha, the dead do not know anything." And the soul sleepers say that that applies to the dead person's abode in heaven. He doesn't know anything after he's dead. Well, actually, he's not in heaven. He's in the grave asleep. His spirit is asleep along with the dead body. And that's why they don't know anything. And so they don't have a reward. Their memory is forgotten. They don't wake up in heaven when they die. This is nonsense. Now, true, the soul sleepers, a lot of them say they're not total annihilationists. They'll say that the soul will wake up in the future sometime. But no, this verse has nothing to do with that vexed theological topic. Solomon is talking about what happens under the sun. His favorite phrase. Dead people don't know anything under the sun in this life. Once they're dead, they can't do anything in this life. And they're forgotten in this life. They're not forgotten by God. They're forgotten by all the other people who are still alive. Verse 6, "Indeed, their love, their hate, and their zeal have already perished. And they will no longer have a share in all that is done." Where? Under the sun. That's what Solomon is talking about. Now, I like to read history, and it occurred to me one time, wow, these people really wanted to carry on their family name, like the Habsburg emperors, and that's all they lived for. And now nobody knows who the Habsburg emperors are, except a few professional historians and history nuts, and they really cared about all this stuff, and now nobody cares. Does anybody care about who has Alsace and Lorraine anymore? Than a new cast of historical characters come on the stage and we look at modern politics, do you think that all what's going on today that people 100 years from now are going to give a flying rip about? No. All the hate and the zeal of current day politicians and polemicists and antagonists is going to be gone. It's going to be perished. Now, people who don't believe in an afterlife have a hard time with death. And they'll do anything to perpetuate their memory on the earth. Gravestones. Think of all the bridge names you see. "This is the Samuel B. Smith Memorial Bridge." Made out of concrete, so it'll last a while. But then pretty soon people will say, as they drive over the bridge, "Who is this Samuel B. Smith? I don't know anything about him. How about all the dormitory names you see on campus? My former college campus had dormitories everywhere. The so-and-so and so-and-so dormitory. The so-and-so and so-and-so dormitory. These rich people probably don't have any idea of the afterlife. They give money and they want to see their name up there to perpetuate their name. I remember when I was in high school, my Presbyterian Sunday school class took a cross-cultural trip to see a Jewish synagogue in my hometown, and the rabbi got up and started talking about how the memory of the Jewish congregation there would be perpetuated by that synagogue, maybe by names on the wall. I can't remember how, but they would create eternity by remembering the dead Jews in this life. And I thought, boy, that is terrible. And of course, I was naive at the time, so I raised my hand and I said, well, you don't believe in an afterlife? No, they didn't. And I've said that when Solomon is writing the book of Ecclesiastes, he's thinking about one thing. What happens when you die? Death ruins everything. And so that's why, by golly, you better believe in an afterlife, or life gets to be pretty bleak. In fact, I think that's a good apologetic method. I used to try to use that on college students when I was in China. I said, do you think you're going to die one day? You're going to die, right? And so what happens then? Of course, they're young. They think they're going to live forever. Actually, my apologetic method didn't work too well because they said, well, I don't worry about that. That's a long time in the future. I remember I told one young lady, I said, hey, you could walk out into that road and get run over tonight. You ever thought about that? Nah, they're not going to die. Well, Solomon's old. He's writing. He knows he's going to die. He continues in verses 7 through 10. Go then, eat your bread in happiness and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given to you under the sun. For this is your reward in life and in your toil in which you have labored under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, for there is no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you are going. Sheol, of course, is the grave. You're going to the grave. Sheol could be death, too. Death of the grave, same thing. You're going to die. Well, given the fact that you're going to die, Solomon suggests then to eat, drink, and be merry. Now, you might think, well, that's not a Christian thing to say. Well, he's talking about this life because he's mentioned that phrase under the sun twice in this passage, verses 7 through 10. And if you don't believe in the afterlife, that is good advice. This is all you've got, so you might as well enjoy it while you can. Now, of course, this is good advice for the one who does believe in the afterlife, too, because God gives us all good things to enjoy in this life. There's nothing wrong with enjoying things in this life, despite all of its evils. So let's unpack this passage a little bit. Verse 7, Solomon says, go eat your bread in happiness. He's speaking to righteous men, not epicures, not gluttons. Eat your bread in happiness, drink your wine. He's saying, eat in moderation and drink in moderation with a cheerful heart. For God has already approved your works. Nothing wrong with eating, nothing wrong with drinking. In moderation, there's nothing wrong with working and making money to buy the bread and the wine. Solomon is clear to say that all the way through the book of Ecclesiastes. He says in verse 8, let your clothes be white all the time. Why white? Well, that would mean they were neat and clean and washed. Also, it could refer to the fact that on festival days, Jews wore white. And so Solomon's saying, feast all the time. Be happy. White would not be worn on a day of mourning, so don't mourn. Enjoy your life in this veil of tears. Not all be. Enjoy life in this veil of tears. And let not oil be lacking on your head. Oil was often poured on the heads of guests at feast to refresh them. And so the point is, go to a lot of feast and enjoy having oil poured on your head. Enjoy life with a woman you love. That would be your wife. Enjoy her all the days of your fleeting life. One woman, one wife. But remember, a wife is only for this life. There's no marriage in heaven. We know that now. I don't know if Solomon knew that. Probably didn't. But he, again, is speaking from the aspect of being under the sun as opposed to being in Sheol in the grave. While you're alive, you better enjoy your wife because you're going to die. Your wife is your reward in life, enjoying life with her. And also in the toil which you have labored under the sun, enjoy that too. That's the reward for all your toil is the life with your wife. You make it, she spends it. In verse 10, Solomon says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Work hard, enjoy. the activities of your life, because there's no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. Now, of course, an eternal life of not doing anything would be absolute hell. In fact, sometimes I wonder if that's what hell is, just sitting around, not roasting in fire, but sitting in the dark with nothing to do. Oh, gosh, in eternity, how awful. We are going to be doing lots of good things in heaven, lots of activity. Randy Alcorn's book called Heaven, I think it's called. Wonderful book. I don't agree with some of his interpretations of the millennium saying that applies to heaven. But with that small caveat, I would suggest you read that book because it's very encouraging about what we're going to do in heaven. We're not going to be floating around in outer space playing harps all day long. But if you don't believe in heaven, you might as well face the fact you're going to be looking at the underside of a coffin top for eternity. Except you're not even going to be able to see that because you're going to be dead. We go now to Ecclesiastes 9, verses 11 through 12. Solomon takes up the story. I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift and the battle is not to the warriors. And neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability. For time and chance overtake them all. Moreover, man does not know his time. Like fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared in an evil time when it suddenly falls on them. So in verse 11, Solomon says, I again saw under the sun, it means in this life, that all the plans and efforts of men were not the reasons for the outcome of events. Providence controls everything. God controls what happens, not men. It doesn't matter if you run fast. It doesn't matter if you are a warrior, a strong warrior in a battle. Then IV has strong there instead of warrior. So if you're a strong man in a battle, you just don't know. That doesn't necessarily guarantee victory. If you follow sports long enough, like I do, you will know that sometimes the teams with the biggest payrolls lose. In fact, most often they do. I just watched an NBA game where the Celtics, my favorite team, had the best record in the NBA. They were playing this pathetic Oklahoma City Thunder team. I say pathetic. They weren't actually pathetic, but their record was pathetic. They were sub-500, one of the weakest teams in the league. And the Thunder scored 150 points, beat the Celtics by 34 points. You just don't know. And that's what Solomon is saying. Here's some examples of some strong warriors who lost the battle they should have won. How about the Midianites? Gideon had 300 people. The Midianites had a host, and Gideon won. The Midianites lost. How about Goliath? He was twice as big as David, I'm sure. Goliath lost. You don't know. Time and chance. So looking at it, remember, not from God's point of view, because there is no time with God, there is no chance with God, but from our view, under the sun, as Solomon says in verse 11, I again saw under the sun in this life, time and chance overtake everybody. You don't know when you're going to die, and you don't know when adversity's coming or prosperity's coming. In fact, and I think it was the previous chapter, chapter 8, Solomon says that God makes both prosperity and adversity, both. So all that's from man's point of view, time and chance. From God's point of view, it's providence. He decides how history is going to turn out, and he decides how your life is going to turn out. You can make all the wise decisions in the world, but you're still going to end up in strange situations, and some of them might not be so good. Verse 12, moreover, man does not know his time, like fish caught in a treacherous net. That fish is swimming along just as happy as it can be, and all of a sudden, whoop, he's in a net, and he's trapped, and he's dead. Bird be pecking along, picking out some worms, and all of a sudden, snap, the snare snaps on the bird's leg, or the bird's head, or the bird's body, and he's finished. He's toast. I've got about 10 more months to finish this podcast. I don't know that I'm going to make it. I hope I do, but I don't know. And so the application here is to turn your life over to God, for only He knows how best to live your life. You don't know. You might do everything right and still, wham! You could die in a car wreck. Somebody runs a red light. You could die in a car wreck. Somebody runs a red light. You just don't know. We go now to Ecclesiastes 9, verses 13 through 16. Also this, Solomon says, I came to see his wisdom under the sun, and it impressed me. Again, under the sun. And the this there could refer to what he just talked about. I think probably here it's referring to what he's about to say in verses 14 through 16. Starting in verse 14, there was a small city with few men in it, and a great king came to it, surrounded it, and constructed large siege works against it. But there was found in it, found in the city, a poor wise man, and he delivered the city by his wisdom. Yet no one remembered that poor man. So I said, wisdom is better than strength. But the wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words are not heeded. The point of all this is to show that, just like running swiftly in a race or being strong in battle doesn't guarantee success, even wisdom does not guarantee success. Even though the wisdom delivered the city, nobody remembers the poor man. All is vanity and striving after the wind. Verse 13, let me repeat. Solomon uses that phrase, under the sun. Remember, all of this advice he's giving and all of these statements of his observations are referring to this life under the sun. If there were no afterlife, everything Solomon is saying makes a lot of sense. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Don't worry about your wisdom being remembered. It's going to be forgotten, so just be wise now and enjoy it. Now, this city with a few men in it that was delivered by the wisdom of the poor man could be a real city. It could be a hypothetical city that Solomon is using to make his point. We really don't know. There are some examples in scriptures and in ancient history of cities delivered by wise people. First, let me give you these examples. A wise woman from Abel Beth Maacah. Now, Abel Beth Maacah was a town right there at the head of the Jordan River above Lake Hula in northern Israel, right west of the southern tip of Mount Hermon, in the vicinity of the Leontes River. And what happened was somebody who was prominent in the rebellion against David and Absalom's rebellion was fleeing and went and took refuge in that city, Abel Beth Maacah. So we read the story in 2 Samuel 20, verses 15 through 22. They came, that's the army of Joab, David's army, came and besieged him. That would be Sheba, son of Bichri. So Joab came and besieged Sheba, son of Bichri, in Abel Beth Maacah, and they cast up a siege ramp against the city, and it stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab were wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall. Then a wise woman called from the city, "Here, here, please tell Joab, come here that I may speak with you." So he approached her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he answered, "I am." Then she said to him, "Listen to the words of your maidservant." And Joab answered, "I'm listening." Then the wise woman spoke, saying, "Formerly they used to say they would surely ask advice at Abel," meaning Abel Beth Maacah, "and thus they ended the dispute." In other words, she's saying, this place is famous for wisdom. "I am of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You are seeking to destroy a city, even a mother in Israel. Why should you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" Joab replied, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. Such is not the case. But a man from the hill country of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has lifted up his hand against King David. Only hand him over, and I will depart from the city." And the woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head will be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman wisely came to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it to Joab. So Joab blew the trumpet, and they were dispersed from the city, each to his tent. So this wise woman saved the whole city with some timely advice. Give up the hostage. But nobody remembers her. Her name's not even given in scripture here. Now here's another example of a man whose wisdom saved a city. This is a great example. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite fit our paradigm here because this man is remembered today. So we'll just take him as an example of how wisdom can save a city. I'm referring to Archimedes of Syracuse, that city on the eastern coast of Sicily. He lived from 287 to 212 BC. The Romans were besieging Syracuse, and Archimedes made himself famous because of his wisdom. He was a brilliant mathematician and an inventor. How did he defend Syracuse from the Romans? Well, he destroyed some Roman ships with burning lenses. Now, that's a good one, isn't it? He invented some pulleys to lift the Roman galleys out of the water, thus smashing some of the galleys and sinking some of the others. He was an incredible mathematical genius. He wanted a sphere and a cylinder to put on his gravesite because he had discovered how to find the surface area of a sphere or a cylinder. Remember, this is 287 to 212 BC that he lived. He's famous for this quote, "Give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum on which to place it, and I shall move the world." So he was big on things such as fluid mechanics, physics, math. He was an incredible genius. And during this siege of Syracuse by the Romans, he was drawing mathematical diagrams on the sand. A soldier came up and interrupted him, and Archimedes, with the typical arrogance of an intellectual, said, "Stand off, soldier, and do not spoil my diagram." Upon which the soldier struck Archimedes dead. You just don't know what's going to happen. The future is not ours to know. But his wisdom did save the city. But Archimedes ended up in Sheol. Here's another story from classical antiquity. Alexander the Great, he's besieging the city of Lampsacus, which is on the eastern shore of the Hellespont, right before you get over there into Troy. Alexander was on his way to conquer Persia. And Alexander had an old teacher named Anaximenes. Anaximenes came out of Lampsacus to meet Alexander as Alexander's getting ready to besiege the city and destroy it. Now, Alexander knew that Anaximenes would plead for the city, of course. So Alexander swore that he would grant nothing that Anaximenes asked for. But Anaximenes was a wise man. He came up to Alexander and he said, "Alexander, please destroy this city." So Alexander had sworn that he would not do what Anaximenes had asked for. And so since Anaximenes had asked that Alexander destroy the city, Alexander was not going to destroy the city. But now who remembers Anaximenes today? A few ancient historians, perhaps, but not many. This is not the famous pre-Socratic philosopher, by the way. Well, going back to Ecclesiastes 9:15, Solomon says, "The poor wise man delivered the city, but nobody remembers the poor man." It could be because of his poverty, his wisdom was not appreciated. Well, even if he hadn't been poor, nobody's going to remember him, because that's the way human beings are. All the suffering in Eastern Europe as they came out from communism. I was living and interested in current events while it was going on. I didn't know what was going on until just recently, listening in a podcast. Also, a young man who grew up down the street from me ended up working for CNN and did a book about the delivery of one of those Eastern European countries. I can't remember which one it was now. And he told of the incredible suffering and valor and bravery of the people who escaped the communist rule. And I can't even remember the name of the country now as I'm telling you. The sufferings of people, the wisdom of people, people don't remember. We go now to Ecclesiastes 9, verses 17 through 18, and we will finish this chapter. Solomon continues, "The words of the wise heard in quietness are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good." Now, what that has to do with the previous words of the chapter, I don't know. So we will just take this in context of itself. The words of the wise heard in quietness, better than the shouting of a ruler. I can think of two rulers, recent rulers in America. They ran against each other for president. One of them, I won't mention his name rhymes with dump. And the other one, his last name, starts with B as in bozo. They are noted for screaming and hollering at their aides when things go wrong. So apparently, being a ruler has a lot of pressure involved with it, and it's easy to shout at your advisors when you're the top dog. Much better to listen to wisdom without shouting. That's why I much prefer a classroom than a political forum. Everybody shouts. I mean, just the other day, on the floor of the United States House of Representatives, the Republicans were having trouble deciding who was going to be Speaker of the House. They had the majority, and one Republican lunges at another Republican and is getting ready to physically assault him. I mean, this is not Taiwan. This is America. This sort of thing does not happen. One congressman said he had been there for 18 years and he'd seen a lot of kerfuffles, but he'd never quite seen anything like this. Another Republican congressman had to grab the attacker from behind and put his hand over his mouth to keep him from shouting. Reminds me of people in a basketball game that get upset and the other players have to restrain him before he gets thrown out of the game. At any rate, screaming and hollering is not the way to debate. That's what's so disgusting about the woke left. They don't debate. They just scream. They demonize. They marginalize. You can't debate with crazy people, especially when they're screaming at you. "You're a racist. You're a xenophobe. You're an Islamophobe. You're a homophobe." The other day I heard about this real famous American women's soccer player who's a lesbian and who is woke, and she said, "It's terrible that it's only been recently that there were three female referees in a FIFA soccer game, football game, And somebody asked her, well, why did it take so long? And she says, because of sexism and racism. The issue had nothing to do with racism. It had to do, perhaps, with sexism because it was women referees, but race had absolutely nothing to do with it because these people are so programmed to talk like robots without thinking. They just shout. Verse 18, wisdom is better than weapons of war. We've just given you examples of how wisdom saves cities. But one sinner destroys much good. An example of that would be Achan when Joshua crossed the Jordan River with the Israelites, took some booty as they took some cities, and Achan took some booty which was dedicated to God. Korban, you weren't supposed to touch it, but Achan hid it under his tent and brought a curse on the city, brought a curse on the Israelites, and they lost the next battle. One sinner destroys much good. I think the very next verse in Ecclesiastes 10 verse 1 says that a fly in the ointment makes the perfume stink. Yes, I just checked it. Dead flies make a perfumer's oil ferment and stink. So a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. But just like one little tiny fly will mess up your perfume, one sinner in your organization, in your church, can destroy a lot of good stuff. That's why, folks, church discipline is extremely important. You cannot let that little bit of leaven the whole lump. You've got to stop it before your church or your business or your partnership or your organization, whatever it is destroyed. You got one basketball player that won't play like the coach wants him to and like the team wants him to, he'll destroy the team. Ladies and gentlemen, with those words of wisdom, we are now prepared to go to Ecclesiastes chapter 10, which I will call the curse of folly. I hope you stay tuned for that exposition, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.